Hello, welcome to another episode of the Telltale Heart, a cardiovascular digest for pharmacists. I'm excited to provide another outstanding episode, or in my opinion, an outstanding episode on a very timely topic that will be talked about at the upcoming ACC meeting. And this meeting is going to drop the Tuesday after the American College of Cardiology meeting. But I know there's a lot of topics or people will be discussing this and putting in context. And so we're going to talk today about the recent released ACC/AHA dyslipidemia guidelines. And I'm excited to have two esteemed folks who were involved on this and good friends. Before we jump into introducing them, I just want to remind you, if you like the podcast and the content, like, subscribe, give us a rating, email us about content you would like to see and all the things that would be helpful related to that. And we will jump in on this. Okay, so I'm going to transition to the episode and start introducing our guests. I think we'll start with one who's been here before, Dr. Joe Sassine. Joe, do you want to introduce yourself, who you are, again, since you've been here a few months ago or a few episodes ago, and where you practice and what you do?
Sure. Thank you, Craig. Thanks for having me. My name is Joe Sassine. I'm Associate Dean for Clinical Affairs and Professor at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus, Skaggs School of Pharmacy and Pharmaceutical Sciences. I oversee our clinical affairs, and I also am a traditional academician where I teach, do some research, and do some other service work. I practice in a primary care clinic as a portion of my job at the university. It's a family medicine clinic where we have a team of clinical pharmacists who provide disease state management and interprofessional care. I also was a member of the 2018 and 2026 Dyslipidemia Guideline Writing Committee, and I'm a former past president of the National Lipid Association. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for coming back. You're like one of the few people that has been here twice. So, well, you're becoming a regular, a recurrent character, if you will. And then Dr. Dave Dixon. Dave, welcome to the podcast and excited to have you on this. Also a good colleague and friend. Dave, could you tell us about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, thanks, Craig, and thanks for having me on. My name is Dave Dixon. I am professor and chair of the Department of Pharmacotherapy and Outcome Science here at Virginia Commonwealth University School of Pharmacy. I practice in a preventive cardiology clinic here at VCU Health with the Pauli Heart Center, and my clinical and research interests are primarily focused on lipid disorders, hypertension, chronic heart failure, and obesity management. And they still let me teach in the classroom a little bit as well. And like Joe, very much involved in many of our professional societies that were involved in developing these guidelines.
Very good. And definitely experts and leaders in the field. So I'm excited to hear their perspectives on this. So this will be somewhat, as I alluded to, a hot off the press episode. I mean, it'll be a couple weeks that these have been dropped by the time this episode is dropped. So maybe people had some time to digest them. And if not, it'll still be good to hear your perspective, both if they've read them or not. So you both had the honor of serving as pharmacists and cardiovascular team members on these guidelines. Joe, you in the writing role, and Dave, you as a part of the peer review team. And maybe I'll start with you, Joe. Can you share with me what your experience was like as a pharmacist on the guideline writing committee? You know, kind of like what was your role? I know you can't get into the semantics of what the decisions were, but you can probably just maybe give perspective of folks what it was like to be as an author on this and how you arrived there and what the process was like, just so, you know, they get an appreciation of what your role was.
Yes, it was actually a very professional and collegial experience. And I can compare what 2018 and 2026, what those two committees were like. It was good in 2018, the last time I did this, but in 2026, I think pharmacists, I felt like we were all equal. There wasn't any hierarchy where the pharmacist was lesser than the physicians or PhDs who are nurses or PAs or dietitians who are part of the writing group. We all were viewed as equal peers, and we shared the work. We had specific assignments. The chair and co-chair were really good at leading the entire effort and sort of herding cats mentality, but discussions were at an appropriate scientific level as far as rigor, but also tailored to the average clinician who has to use these guidelines. So the process was a scientific approach tailored to the needs of a clinician. The scientific approach was really the approach to looking at evidence and translating that into actionable clinical recommendations, ranking them with a class of recommendation and also a level of evidence, following the protocols for how to actually summarize information, being succinct with your words. So overall, this was a very, I think, evidence-based, rigorous process that was very collegial and very welcoming of my area of expertise as a clinical pharmacist. So I couldn't have been happier with how the process went. With that said, things don't always happen quickly, but if you think about everything that's in that guideline, it's amazing that we got it done within less than 2 years, because there are a lot of steps of approval, but what might seem on paper is a long period of time actually flew by pretty quick.
Very good. And Dave, to your process, what was it like as the peer reviewer and kind of your role in this process?
Yeah, so it's always a, tremendous honor to be involved in these documents that are so critical to informing patient care and ultimately improving clinical outcomes. So I served on the peer review committee, and this is a relatively newer process where the Joint Committee on Clinical Practice Guidelines not only establishes the writing committee, but they also establish the peer review committee that has the important role of providing a rigorous review of the guidelines and ensuring that all of the various rules that have to be followed are followed, and that the resulting guideline, of course, adheres to the evidence standards, that the recommendations are in line with that evidence, and that the guideline, of course, is digestible. I also serve on the Joint Committee on Clinical Practice Guidelines, and so in some ways have had a dual role, given that that group oversees the development of all of the ACC and AHA guidelines. And I've been fortunate to be involved in several of these and other types of documents. And, every time I learn something new, really feel valued as a member of the committee. And that was the same with the peer review committee. We had some great discussions that really led to, I think, some very helpful feedback that again helped shape the guideline. And again, it's been really terrific seeing the increased number of opportunities for pharmacists to participate in the development of clinical practice guidelines, which, as we know, are increasingly very medication focused. So it makes a lot of sense that pharmacists are re well represented on these.
Yeah. And what I love about this, and not just pharmacists, but even team-based care, the guidelines have really taken a broad approach of making sure that they acknowledge and reflect that this is a team-based care process. So I appreciate it's not just representation, which is great and very important, but it's even, and maybe through the representation, the acknowledgement of team-based care is a part of the disease state management process continually. So I think that that is outstanding. So let's kind of jump into this. And I think everyone knows the answer to this question, but it's still worth posing and asking, and maybe to hear your two perspectives on this as experts in the field of lipid management. So why now and why is this important? And maybe that gives people a historical context of, since 2018, things that have continued to evolve and change. So I'm going to switch it up and I'm going to start with you, Dave. So in your opinion, why is this critical that these guidelines are coming out now and so important for clinicians and patients?
Yeah, so yeah, 2018 was a while ago, right? And if you think about all that has changed in terms of emerging evidence, emerging non-statin therapies, and the data we have behind them, it was really time and overdue for an update. And I think some additional key aspects are that we really have strong evidence now, really supporting that lifetime LDL exposure is the right way to think about LDL-associated risk. We also have better risk prediction tools with the PREVENT score. We have increasing clarity on the role of using additional lipid parameters such as ApoB, the data behind the role of coronary artery calcium scoring, and a clearer definition of the importance of subclinical atherosclerosis. And again, as I mentioned, the role of non-statin therapies. So it's a really exciting time in lipids, and I think the new guidelines are a real advancement that will improve patient care. And again, we're much needed given this expanding evidence base over the past, 7 or 8 years since the last update.
Very good. And Joe, kind of what's your perspective on this?
I'm going to concur with everything that Dave said and just add a little bit more. I mean, those advances in science really say we can't use a guideline that was written 8 years ago. There's more information, it's incorporated, it's contemporary, we have better ability to predict risk. I think we have even more evidence that treating dyslipidemia earlier reduces lifetime risk and that we need to focus on our higher risk patients and really treat them aggressively. Here's why we need it now. We're not doing a good job. This is not novel or new that elevated LDL cholesterol or atherogenic lipoproteins leads to ASCVD. We've known that for decades, but the needle hasn't moved significantly. We have too many people that are not treated or are undertreated. We have a problem with initiating therapy. We have a problem with patients accepting therapy. We have a problem with achieving goals, which are now very clearly laid out. And we have a problem with accepting drugs. We have problems accepting drugs from a patient perspective, which are statin-based, but also accepting the need to add on non-statins for further reductions. I don't want to paint a completely bleak picture. There are many clinicians that provide exquisite care, the bottom line fact is that there's too many people who are undertreated from a cardiovascular risk reduction standpoint. And if this promulgates advances in risk reduction, it's further justified. Why now is the right time?
Sure. That's great. So I'm going to kind of jump into this and I'll start with you, Joe. Kind of in your mind, what are the key takeaways or things that you want people to A, be aware of, and then also I know you would refer them to check them out further in the guidelines or any other evidence. So in your mind, what are a couple of things that are really critical that are different that people need to be aware of or pay attention to?
Certainly, there are a lot, like you said, but and when I look at the top 10 messages, if I had to distill and just cherry pick a few of them that really stand out, one for our primary prevention patients, we have a new risk prediction tool called the PREVENT Calculator. And it is different than the pooled cohort equations. It's different from an operational standpoint by some of the inputs, which are great improvements. The two big things that are really different is that it's more accurate at predicting true cardiovascular risk for ASCVD, which is needed in our primary prevention patients to dictate what their therapy should be. And we need to get sort of used to the different cutoffs. It's not the same cutoff values that we used as benchmarks with the pooled cohort equations. So that is something noteworthy. The biggest thing is that we have LDL goals in their back. We don't have to get into this nuance of what do we frame it as, the value to achieve, the threshold, whatever, yada, yada, yada. It's a goal. And it's LDL cholesterol along with non-HDL cholesterol, very important. Even ApoB would be appropriate to measure in some patients under some circumstances. And I guess the last one that I'll call out, and it's not surprising that we have low LDL goals for our highest risk patients, but what Dave already mentioned was coronary artery calcium scoring really is an additional personalized risk assessment tool that has been growing. And it's even more prominent, and we have further guidance on how to interpret and manage patients based on those results.
And just briefly, can you just, as a side note, in case people don't know what a coronary artery calcium score is and how it's used,
Yeah,
you
let
don't
me
have to
give you
go into
the,
the yeah, and then not the
yep.
high level.
I'll give you the nutshell version. Basically, coronary artery calcium is a quick scan of your coronary arteries to see if there's atherosclerosis brewing there already. What it picks up on is calcification, which is a marker of hard plaque in your arteries. So we can, if you just get in the mind of a patient, if you're not certain, if you're a primary prevention patient, you don't, your risk could be low, borderline, intermediate, or high. High, pretty clear you should treat. But some of those other patients may not want therapy. They may want to say, I'm not sure I need it. Our clinicians might be, I'm not sure you really need it, even though you have some things ongoing. But if we can look at somebody's arteries and say, you already have atherosclerosis starting, that's what CAC picks up on. A simple scan, it looks at hard plaque. It's not 100% perfect because some people, before they develop hard plaque, have soft plaque, which won't be calcified, but it does give a very personalized look at your patient's individual arteries to see if they have measurable coronary artery calcium. If they do, it's a clear message, especially depending on how much is there, that risk reduction through LDL lowering will provide benefit and is recommended.
Yeah, and that just I refer people to the guidelines, but just to give some context, the recommendation for coronary artery calcium has kind of been slightly elevated, correct, in this set of guidelines.
It has been elevated, not only encouraging people to do it, but we have now very clear guidance as far as if you score between what I call the single or double digits, between 1 and 99, you can consider a statin. If you score a little bit higher, which is in the lower ranges of 100 to 299, there's also another interpretation that you need to compare yourself to your percentile of your population for younger patients, because a number might not look that high, but it might be pretty high if you're a younger patient. So there's that percentile, 75th percentile or higher, which sort of classifies people as, having a lot of plaque. For those patients, 100 and higher is where we should consider high intensity statin therapy. And we get to a point where, when you have patients with extensive coronary artery calcification, when they're in the four digits, 1,000 or higher, based on the measured amount of coronary artery calcium, where not only should we use a high intensity statin, but we treat people like they're a secondary prevention patient with an optional LDL goal less than 55. So we've not only gotten pretty clear on who should use statin-based therapy, but adding goals, which really will help our clinicians interpret this appropriately. The last thing I'll say about coronary artery calcium, some people don't have the formal coronary artery calcium scan at the heart. They have what's called incidental CAC, that is CAC being coronary artery calcium, that's picked up on a scan. Maybe they're having a lung scan to look for lung cancer as a routine screening. Sometimes that can pick up on incidentally find coronary artery calcium. And there's even some guidance on whether it's mild or moderate or severe on what to do as a clinician.
Very good. Dave, what about you? Anything different from your mind or additional that you think of, like some kind of other key takeaways or constructs? And you can maybe reinforce them. It's totally up to you.
Yeah, so Joe obviously did a great job summarizing some of the key updates and changes. A couple additional points. So the PREVENT risk calculator, which again is replacing the ASCVD risk estimator, that calculator has three outputs. It can estimate the risk of total cardiovascular disease, which includes ASCVD and heart failure risk. Then you can look at ASCVD risk and heart failure risk individually. And so it's important that when assessing patients and primary prevention patients for statin eligibility, that we have to use the PREVENT ASCVD score. And so that's going to be an important aspect of implementation and communicating to clinicians to make sure that the PREVENT ASCVD button on the calculator is clicked. In addition to that, the guideline took a step further in terms of making, broadly recommending Lp(a) screening for all adults to help with refining ASCVD risk. And Lp(a) is an LDL-like lipoprotein that is primarily an inheritable lipoprotein that is independently associated with ASCVD risk, independent of LDL. And while we do not yet have a FDA-approved drug therapy that specifically reduces Lp(a) associated risk, there are multiple agents in the pipeline. And I get this question a lot as to, why would I check this if I can't treat it? And I understand the question, but I think it's important that patients are screened because the risk of a patient and them understanding that risk often is a motivating factor for them to accept treatment and to stay adherent to that treatment over time. And there are other factors that we look at that we can't treat, and age is a big one, right? Out of all the things we talk about with ASCVD risk, it is a fact that age is really the predominant risk factor at the end of the day. Yet we, unfortunately, don't have a treatment for aging. We can't reverse aging, not yet. But we still consider that in the overall risk assessment. So I think that Lp(a) screening being a class one recommendation is still really important and puts our US guidelines in alignment with our European colleagues and also recommendations from the National Lipid Association. So I think those are a couple of key points that I would add.
And just to
Dave,
add to
that
that, okay, go ahead, Joe.
I
Yeah,
was gonna
sorry,
say,
go
Dave,
ahead.
that's a great summary of it. And the only thing I'll also add is what I found useful is because it's an a genetically inherited characteristic, is even if patients don't take their own health care as seriously, when you mention you may have passed this along to your child, that sometimes gets them to pay a little bit more closer attention. So if you do have a patient and you screen for Lp(a) and it's very high, then cascade screening of their primary relatives also is important.
Great point.
Yeah, which goes to that life, across the spectrum, management of hyperlipidemia and disorders. So just so we're clear, the screening for Lp(a) is just at least once to identify those individuals at high risk at ASCVD, right? So as an adult, having that at least once is correct, Dave, is
Yes,
the
that's correct.
suggestion. Yep. Okay. Very good. And I know that's something people are slowly learning about and what the uptake of that is and how to put that in practice. So that is exciting that it's in the guidelines. So maybe it'll help, expand that process. So just briefly, one thing that I'd like to call out, and Joe kind of alluded to this with ranges, but Joe, do you want to explain, maybe we talk about a minute for secondary prevention. How low are we trying to get to for a patient in that area at this point?
For there's two there's me I was going to say two camps to this, but when you have a patient with secondary prevention, the traditional most evidence-based approach traditionally has been an LDL less than 70, and then for very high-risk patients to get that LDL less than 55. And whenever I say LDL, add 30 to it, and that's your non-HDL goal. So if you're targeting less than 55 for your LDL, you must also get your non-HDL less than 85 to accommodate that residual risk. That's the biggest recommendations in the guidelines, but there is this optional goal for any patient with who's secondary prevention to apply the more intense LDL goal less than 55. And you may be scratching your head, what is this secondary prevention? We have very high risk and then we have not very high risk patients. That is something that, was a technical thing that our evidence that was the highest level used criteria to identify people who are very high risk with ASCVD. And for example, these were patients who had at least one real acute event, whether it's a myocardial infarction or a stroke, plus multiple high risk conditions, or your people have multiple events. That's considered very high risk. So who does that leave out? It leaves out your patients that have maybe chronic stable angina, or who have had chest pain that's been treated with revascularization. So they never had their event, or they have a TIA, or they have, some form of PAD that's maybe not symptomatic, but really bad based on your ABI score. So when you look at clinical ASCVD, we always had those two buckets. I'll tell you, some of that's moot, and guidelines and evidence moves at rapid pace. After these guidelines, drafts were made, and it was well into the peer review process, the Vesalius data came out. And what it basically did is it looked at everybody who is clinical ASCVD, who is not considered very high risk. And they sort of proved that less than 55, that's what they achieved in this Vesalius study, which was statin-based therapy plus PCSK9 monoclonal antibody versus placebo. They sort of proved that less than 55 is good for all ASCVD patients. So it's in the guidelines as an optional goal. I, as an individual practitioner, I will apply that as the standard goal. Even though I recognize the guidelines have it as optional, the evidence supports that. And as another FYI, high-risk diabetes patients were included in that Vesalius study too, and they had benefit, and they were treated to LDLs that on average were less than 55. It also included people with subclinical atherosclerosis as determined by coronary artery calcification. So that's another population that has ASCVD. It may not, it's subclinical, but they benefited from that intense goal also.
Just if people aren't aware, Joe was on several months ago, and this is where I refer to him being repeat guest. He did talk about the Vesalius trial, so I would encourage people to go back and listen to that, and you can get a full in-depth analysis of this. This was right after the AHA meeting from that standpoint. So let's talk a little bit around pharmacotherapy. And Dave, maybe I'll turn this to you. Is there anything as pharmacists should think about? We've talked a lot about the the treatment in the ranges. Is there any groundbreaking thought process? I mean, we're still obviously starting out with high intensity statins. As you get to that next layer, what are the things the guidelines are calling out at this particular juncture, or how we're going through with the patients?
So, once
Or
a
not, or appropriate statin therapy, not just high intensity, like depending on their risk, right? Appropriate statin therapy. But
Sure.
okay, so.
So, yeah, patients on, maximally tolerated statin therapy, and so that could be the recommended intensity based on the risk, or it could be what they can tolerate. And then, of course, we will have some patients with complete statin intolerance that may not be on statin therapy at all. And currently, what's really happened over the last 15 years or so is, we've got great options. I can remember early in my career, it was very tough in those patients in terms of trying to get the LDLs down, given the limited options that we had. And so the guidelines kind of reinforce that we really got, three kind of core groups of drugs. So ezetimibe, of course, which that and bempedoic acid both provide up to a 25%, reduction in LDL cholesterol. And so for those patients that, are within that range of being at goal, those are seemingly good options. And of course, there's the combination products of ezetimibe and bempedoic acid. And the good news is that ezetimibe and a bempedoic acid do have supporting clinical data that these drugs not only reduce LDL cholesterol, but also ASCVD risk. And then, of course, both of our PCSK9 monoclonal antibodies, which again have been on the market for quite a while now and have robust clinical data, providing up to a 60% reduction in LDL cholesterol. So I think about certainly utilizing those therapies for patients who have a significant ways to go in terms of achieving their LDL goal. And glycerin, of course, is the one of the newer options that we have, and that's the PCSK9 synthesis inhibitor, the siRNA therapy that prevents the production of PCSK9 in the liver. And while it reduces LDL cholesterol by approximately 50%, we are still waiting on the results of inclisiran's clinical outcome trial, which I believe will be hopefully out within the next year or so. And then maybe your listeners may not be familiar, or maybe a lot of people don't know, but there was actually a third generation PCSK9 inhibitor therapy approved back in December of 2025, lirodalcibep, that is an adnectin-based therapy that targets PCSK9 function and can be administered once a month. It's truly a once-a-month option. As with inclisiran, of course, we don't yet have the clinical outcomes trial data, so that is still pending. So lots of great options. There's more in the pipeline. There's an oral PCSK9 therapy, enlicitide, that is plugging along as well. So the good news is that we're going to have a lot of great options to help patients get to goal, whether, with whatever dose of statin they're able to tolerate, or even if they're statin intolerant. So it's exciting from that standpoint.
And just Joe has also talked about the oral PCSK9 on that last episode. If people want to know about that trial data reporting out and go back into our archives, very good. That's a great summary and overview, Dave. Joe, can you talk briefly about, and this may be another concept people aren't fully aware of, but is outlined in the guidelines, about ApoB and what that means for folks and so forth.
Sure. ApoB is another lipid biomarker that can be measured. It is the purest, I guess, marker or lipoprotein for that is atherogenic. We use LDL cholesterol, and our guidelines are built around LDL cholesterol, and our clinical trials are also, but we've seen actually more and more attention go to non-HDL and ApoB. What's the difference? Well, every LDL, I guess, molecule is attached to an ApoB. And LDL can be variable, almost like Lp(a) can be variable. LDL can be small and dense or bigger and less dense. So there is in the small dense is atherogenic, is the more atherogenic than the opposite. So a lot of clinicians will look at ApoB as being the purest, best measurement. It's just not ingrained into our clinical practice. So it is a better way of looking at the atherogenic lipoproteins. What kind of patient is it worth looking at ApoB? Well, if you have a patient where we expect what we call discordance, which is where the ApoB predicts cardiovascular events better than LDL cholesterol, so it's where it's more accurate. We see that in patients who have metabolic syndrome, which I know that's the old term for CKM syndrome. So people with CKM syndrome, people with type 2 diabetes, people with higher triglyceride values, or even clinical ASCVD. These are the populations where maybe considering ApoB is good. But and you can do it initially, but the best use of it really, if you read into the guidelines, my interpretation is once you've gotten to your LDL and non-HDL goal, in those patients, you may consider it earlier, the ones that I called out, like the metabolic type of patients. But to confirm that you're really at a point where you've minimized atherogenic lipoproteins the most, once you've gotten to those standard LDL and non-HDL goals, you can confirm it, especially in your clinical ASCVD patients with looking at ApoB. ApoB cut points are always the measured numbers always higher than the LDL cut point until you start getting to an LDL 70. Once you get to an LDL 70, the ApoB measurement is about the same as the LDL measurement in somebody who does not have discordance. So when you, if you do look at it, expect the numbers to be a little bit different, but really being the most pure measure of ApoB, you can reserve that to when you're at goal. And I will call on Dave a little bit because he's actually he always has good stories about patient experiences, and I think he's got one that he shared with me in the past about ApoB. Dave, do you want to share?
Yeah, that'd be great. So, just recently, actually, a patient referred to me, and lipid panel results. This patient, of course, not on treatment at all, with triglyceride levels of 777, an LDL cholesterol of 83. And this patient, if you look back through prior clinical notes, there was very little comment about the LDL because at 83, it looked pretty good. This is a younger patient in their early 40s, no prior history of ASCVD. And so we obtained an ApoB, which came back at 148. So,
Wow, that's
yeah,
pretty high.
right? That's pretty high. And so, immediately, we shift into a very different conversation with that patient, and we're able to explain, the limitations of LDL in her case. And so it's definitely a really powerful tool in situations where, again, the LDL alone can be misleading. So I think it's great that the guidelines provided clear guidance on when and how to use ApoB.
Very good. So one thing I'll briefly make a comment on, and you guys can most certainly provide commentary on, and then we'll talk a little bit about pharmacists being engaged in lipid management. I do appreciate the CPR framework for the primary prevention that kind of got together, looking at the borderline risk, and that's to calculate and classify, which you're going to use your prevent ASCVD to estimate the 10-year risk. And of course, like we've seen before, you have the low borderline intermediate risk, but then you're going to personalize that risk and do some discussion and use some shared decision making and help them understand what that risk means. And then you do that reclassifying and reassessment, and that's where we talk about that, coronary artery calcium score, other scores, maybe they have inflammatory markers or other pieces that help that. And then at that point, you're going to decide and treat from that same point. Is Can you guys maybe share your thoughts on how that got devised, or what the beauty of that is?
I'll start a little bit. I think the CPR framework, it probably depends on the clinician and what works best. There's a great table for the CPR framework, which really highlights risk stratification and evaluation in your primary prevention patients. So if some people are oriented to already do that risk assessment and just go to where the treatment benefit algorithm is, but what this layout is how to really interpret the in your primary prevention patient who doesn't have severe hypercholesterolemia, how to interpret their prevent ASCVD 10-year risk score. So it gives you an algorithm of whether somebody's low, borderline, intermediate, or high, as you had said, and sort of puts together some of the thought process. And this might be positioned as a helpful framework for explaining in your patient clinician discussion the benefits versus risk of therapy. And I want to emphasize, I'm using the term very specifically, benefit versus risk. As pharmacists, we are trained to evaluate risk versus benefit. And what a shame we have done to the profession by saying that, because we highlight risk before we highlight benefit. So we purposefully have used benefit before risk, because the bottom line is that there's insurmountable benefit with these lipid-lowering drugs, though there is risk, the benefit still outweighs risk in general. So I guess, coming back on task, the CPR framework, I think, does, help a lot of clinicians with risk stratification evaluation, and perhaps it's also a good framework to share with your patients when you're talking about, how they would benefit from treatment.
Very good. Dave, anything on that? Are you?
Yeah, I would just add that, if you think back to ATP3, it was fairly simple to simply count the number of ASCVD risk factors, look to see if the patient had had an event, go to the table, look at the goal, and treat the patient. The challenge there, of course, is that we're lumping a lot of patients together and probably under and maybe even over treating some patients on the primary prevention side. And so over time, what we've been able to do is really get more sophisticated in looking at assessing ASCVD risk in the primary prevention population. The challenge with that is that there's a lot of nuance, right? It gets more complicated. So I think the CPR framework is an incredibly important tool to help clinicians sort of wrap their heads around, how do I assess risk in this younger patient? And an important point I don't think we've made about the PREVENT calculator is that that 10-year risk estimation can now start at age 30. So ASCVD risk estimator was 40 years of age. And so we can actually kind of start those 10-year risk assessments and those conversations earlier. But again, that does introduce complexity. So I think the CPR framework is very helpful from that standpoint.
Very good. Any other last things on the updates or things to think of the guidelines?
I guess the one thing I'll say with the guidelines
Yeah.
is just disseminating information and standards of care is always a challenge and always important. And I'm thinking about some people in our audience who are pharmacists that participate in prior authorizations. Our prior authorization criteria doesn't always catch up with evidence or guideline recommendations as quick as we would like. So I think knowing about these guidelines can help us increase access of expensive medicines to our patients when the guidelines are more open to recommending a therapy than somebody's insurance criteria is. So I think knowing about them and pushing and leaning into them and putting them into our prior auth criteria when we're trying to get a prior authorized drug, I think is important.
Very good. Dave, anything else for you?
I would just tell pharmacists that this is exactly the moment to lean in. The guideline creates a bigger role for clinicians who can translate this complex evidence into workflows that can address treatment gaps. And so I think pharmacists are just really well positioned to build off of prior efforts to put these new protocols into place and ultimately improve outcomes.
So this that Dave, you're putting me in a great transition to the question I have to ask. So, and you guys both have built a lot of programs around this, and I think both in clinical settings and Dave or Joe, you mentioned even the specialty care type setting to some extent. But how do you encourage pharmacists to be engaged in lipid management, or what could they be doing, in any domain, whether it be hospital clinic, whether it be community-based pharmacy, if you could maybe think about that and address that and just really talk about how we can empower and impact, this process for our patients. Both of you, I'd love to hear your perspective.
Yeah, there's a lot I think that we both can say about this. I guess a lot of pharmacists in clinic-based settings, or even in any community pharmacy or even hospital, we need to think what is in the best interest of our patient holistically. And sometimes we get caught up and we're managing diabetes, we're managing hypertension, get them to their blood pressure goal, their A1C goal. But lipid management is important for that patient holistically. And I know that we always have limited time with our patients, but trying to elevate the profile of cholesterol management is important. I wish our payment mechanisms for disease state management services were a little bit better. We have had advances just across the country. We have access increase. I mean, for example, in Colorado, we have a statewide protocol that allows pharmacists to actually initiate statin therapy in somebody who's in an outlined guideline recommended benefit group. And that's even more expanded now. I guess I would encourage pharmacists to remember what they were trained to do. It doesn't matter if you have a residency or if you don't. It doesn't matter if you're in an academic job or a regular clinical job or a practice setting job. We have a lot of knowledge and ability to influence treatment decisions, whether it be actively making the recommendation or implementing the therapies ourselves. I always sort of remind people, we used to say that pharmacists don't prescribe or diagnose. I've heard pharmacists say that all the time. But guess who wants us to teach students how to prescribe and diagnose? It's ACPE. So our accreditation standard is becoming more and more progressive and requiring that we teach those skills to our students. And it's got to be for a reason. The opportunity to become even more engaged in direct patient care is just going to continue to escalate as we have the cliff of primary care providers where we're dropping off of it. And it's going to get even worse as far as patients getting access to a provider who can provide preventive primary care. And we as a profession are trained to do this. We got a lot of work to do with payment mechanisms to actually make it sustainable. But those are hopefully some things that motivate people. I realize it is hard to work in healthcare. You have a limited amount of time and there's a lot of things we must do. I'm hopeful that someday payment will be even more prevalent than it is right now. And I'm also hopeful that someday CMS in the very near future will recognize LDL cholesterol values as a quality measure, because that will financially incentivize health systems and perhaps even pharmacists to push care towards reducing LDL cholesterol to recommended amounts.
Very good. Dave?
That was a great summary, and I'm glad you mentioned the need to bring back the LDL quality measure. And I'm hopeful that now that we are 100% back to very clear goals for LDL cholesterol, that we can make progress on that. From a health system perspective, you know, pharmacists in that setting, you know, I think figuring out at your institution, you know, is there someone already kind of involved or trying to lead the efforts at a health system level, whether it's helping to you know, update the electronic medical record so that the Prevent ASCVD risk calculator, for example, is integrated, or figuring out, you know, what is your proportion of patients that are not at goal and thinking about things from a population health perspective. And if that leader, you know, if there's no one leading that charge or your institution, it can be you. I think that we as pharmacists, you know, increasingly have to, you know, be willing to kind of step up to the plate. Especially with some of these larger initiatives at our health systems. And on the community pharmacy side of things, just really critical, because individuals in that setting are really the first to spot adherence problems and can play a role in helping identify statin intolerance, but also maybe more importantly, educate patients on statin intolerance and what it is and what it isn't, which continues to be a limitation to getting patients on statins. Helping to address therapeutic inertia, which continues to unfortunately be a widespread issue where a patient may encounter a clinician multiple times and not have the uncontrolled aspects such as the LDL addressed, or their blood pressure is elevated and it continues to stay elevated because there's no action. And then in the managed care and specialty pharmacy side, which I think we've touched on a little bit, you know, access to these non-statin therapies is really critical. And if you think back to the PCSK9 MABs, there was some early data that individuals that were getting denied access to those therapies were actually at higher risk of events and were having more events after that time frame of getting denied. And so our pharmacists in those settings are just immensely critical to helping us get patients on those preventive therapies and getting patients to goal. So so much opportunity. And I think that the new guidelines really kind of set the stage for pharmacists to jump in and get their hands dirty.
Very nice. All right. Those were some great implementation strategies. So wonderful. So kind of, Joe's done this before, we transition. These are a non-clinical question to show that we are not just doing cardiology work. So I'll start with you, Joe, and maybe this has changed since you last answered this question. Anything you're currently reading, listening, or watching kind of at this point?
You know, I can't remember what my previous answer was, but what I enjoy right now, it sounds sort of dorky and too work-related, but I do like watching The Pit right now.
Okay, that's a popular answer, right?
Yeah, I hope so. And they finally had a mention of a pharmacist and a brief glimpse of somebody standing next to a medicine box, which was, better than nothing. I think they can develop that character more to be meaningful, but I enjoy watching it. It's interesting. If you have a medical background, I think it makes you sort of have a good appreciation for what we do that is valuable and highlights to the lay public what it's really like to be in healthcare.
Dave?
So right now, my wife and I are watching Shrinking on Apple TV, and we're kind of late coming around to that show. I think it's in its third season. But really, really funny, first off, but I think more importantly, really doing a great job of kind of highlighting, the importance of mental health and, how we all struggle with things and, the importance of really just communicating, with our friends, our colleagues, and loved ones. So that show I think is really worth checking out. And of course, today is opening day for the baseball season. So I am really excited about that. And I will actually be going to the Dodgers Diamondbacks game this Saturday while I am at the American Pharmacists Association in LA. So
Although the
very
Yankees won
cool.
yesterday.
They did. That was opening night. We are now at
Opening
opening
night. Oh,
day.
okay. There we go.
Very good. So, Joe, and you kind of did this on your last podcast. People wanted to find you. Where could they find you or look you up?
Yeah, I'm not much of a social media person, but I do have a LinkedIn profile that for professional purposes I enjoy.
Okay. And Dave?
Yeah, likewise. So I am on LinkedIn and try to be active there. And then completely unwork related, if you are into baseball card collecting, I am on Instagram at Dave's Braves Cards if you want to talk cards.
My son has gotten into baseball cards and sports cards, so I may send him to your site, Dave.
Good for
So
him.
he's very ambitious and thinks every card's worth a ton of money. And I'm like, okay. So we're teaching him about that. So, but anyways, very good. Well, I appreciate you guys both taking the time and being here, and we'll share this. So very good. And as always, if you liked what this content, please like and subscribe and comment and vote for us and let us know what you want to hear. And we'll see you at the next episode, which will have some debrief from the ACC meeting, American College of Cardiology meeting that's happening this weekend in New Orleans, while APHA is also going on. So thank you all, and please join us next time for another episode of The Telltale Heart, a Cardiovascular Digest for Pharmacists.